You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show:
there may be a possibility that you get some type of limited stability in Afghanistan, but that will come from the Afghans themselves. I don't think you can say in any respect that U.S. military forces have really brought about a coherent and stable Afghanistan over 13 years, and the best that Obama can do is try to cover up that.
From Kabul and California to Gezi Park and Benghazi, we'll review the day's top news stories with Jeffrey Kaufman and James Boyes here in the studio. Then visionary designer Massimo Vignelli has died. Monocle's design editor Tom Morris and creative director Richard Spencer Powell look back on his life and times.
He felt there was only ever sort of 8 or 9 good typefaces in the world. He set up his store with quite a kind of constrained set of parameters, and yet still was colourful, playful, could deliver charm.
And later in the show,
better forget him.
Forget her.
Him with his nose in the
her
air.
Her with her nose in the air.
Oh yes, we'll review the latest and greatest in theatre with Matt Wolf of the International New York Times. All that and much more right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here in the next hour on Midori House, but before any of that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News with Jonathan Wheatley. European Union leaders have ordered a review of its future direction after voters in many countries backed parties opposed to greater integration after elections across Europe last Sunday. Pro-EU parties still hold a majority in the European Parliament. Dave Keating, a reporter based in Brussels, says a meeting of Europe's leaders failed to come up with any concrete plan to win round sceptical citizens.
It was a pretty somber gathering, I would say. There is a feeling that there has been a very strong message sent, but I think that EU leaders are not yet sure how to respond to the message. Right now it's kind of a game of who's too extreme for who. Everyone's kind of looking to their right and saying, oh, well, that party is too far to the right, so they can't be part of my group.
Ukraine has appealed for Russia to tighten border controls and prevent the flow of, as it put it, fighters and terrorists onto Ukrainian soil. The news comes as the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov repeated Moscow's call for an end to the interim Ukrainian government's military action against pro-Russian separatists. Government forces have killed dozens of rebels in the eastern Donetsk province on Monday and Tuesday. Thousands of people have gathered for a memorial service for the 6 people killed in an attack at a university in California. They were stabbed and shot by Elliot Roger, who'd warned online he planned the attack at the University of California Santa Barbara campus. Well, the president of the University of California, Janet Napolitano, says the crimes have shaken the entire community.
We are here because in this moment of loss, there is a human desire to come together, to reach out to one another for love and for support. We are here because we want to share memories of the young lives struck down far too soon.
Outgoing Afghan President Hamid Karzai has welcomed a US decision to withdraw all troops by the end of 2016, saying that this should give the Taliban a reason to end its insurgency and negotiate with the next government. US President Barack Obama plans to withdraw all but 9,800 American troops by the end of the year and pull out the rest by the end of 2016. An organic farmer in Western Australia has lost his bid to claim damages from a neighbour after genetically modified canola seed heads blew onto his property, causing him to lose his licence as an organic grower. The Supreme Court of Western Australia ruled on Wednesday against the organic farmer Steve Marsh, who sued his former friend Michael Baxter after winds carried harvested seed from Baxter's canola crop onto Marsh's farm.
I thought everything was by the law, everything was legal. It's a common practice around all farming communities. It's a legal product. There's nothing not safe about it. Nothing been proven not safe about it.
And finally, it's been revealed the moon now has faster broadband speeds than most homes here in Britain, thanks to NASA scientists and a little help from Star Trek. Space boffins were able to beam the internet via a laser through their telescopes over the 240,000-mile distance at speeds of 19.44 megabytes per second, which is faster than the UK average speed of 18 megabytes. The lasers picked up on a satellite orbiting the moon and focused into an optic fibre before being converted back into data, which is similar to the scientific theory behind Star Trek's transporter used to beam humans to different locations. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. Jonathan, I'm so sorry I said Paul. That's because I was listening there to the music from the pyjama game.
Oh, right, okay, which would put you off anything.
But no, I was getting a bit carried away with the pyjama. I was singing along and then suddenly I didn't look up to see who had snuck in to do the news and I got it wrong. I apologise.
I don't look like Paul Osborne though, do I?
No.
No, good.
No, not at all. But you both look nice in pyjamas.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you very much. That's, of course, Jonathan Wheatley, who's going to be back in another kind of 30 minutes to give us a roundup of the headlines. But we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. You're listening to Midori House. And time now to take a look at the stories making the news today. Here in the studio is London-based journalist, writer and veteran network TV news correspondent Jeffrey Kaufman. And also here is Dr. James Boyes, a political historian and author of the forthcoming book, Clinton's Grand Strategy. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start the show with Afghanistan. In a surprise visit today, US President Barack Obama has announced that it's time to turn the page on a decade of war. The last American troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan by the end of 2016, he said. Jeffrey and James, before we get into the nuts and bolts of this, let's first have a listen to this from Scott Lucas of Birmingham University. We spoke to him just a little bit earlier.
You know, no one can pretend that this is the way the U.S. wanted Afghanistan to wind up. At best, you can say that Obama's trying to have a managed withdrawal from what has been a conflict that's taken place now for almost 13 years that has involved tens of thousands of American forces, cost thousands of American lives, and has not achieved the aims that America set out. Your listeners may recall that initially U.S. forces supposedly went into Afghanistan, bombed the country, to capture Osama bin Laden. That they didn't do. And in fact, they never came close to it at that point. They then said they were going to restore stability to Afghanistan. They really haven't come close to achieving that. There may be a possibility that you get some type of limited stability in Afghanistan, but that will come from the Afghans themselves. I don't think you can say in any respect that U.S. military forces have really brought about a coherent and stable Afghanistan over 13 years, and the best that Obama can do is try to cover up that, while at the same time, and this is an important thing, he's not withdrawing from Afghanistan. He's leaving 10,000 troops there. So what are those 10,000 troops doing over the next 2 years? Why is America still staying in Afghanistan until 2016? What type of strategy does it have? None of those questions are really being answered today.
Jeffrey, over the last few months, few years, you know, obviously Obama has been heavily criticised for having a foreign policy that many felt was weak and a failure, and for not kind of getting the decisive wins that it was felt that he should have had. Maybe he's been a little bit luckier with Ukraine. But when you look at what he's talking about now, the money he's putting aside for anti-terrorism, this idea that he needs to kind of make, you know, America needs to do things with the allies a lot more. What do you think is the reading that we should take of the comments he's made over the last few days?
Listen, he didn't create this war. He inherited Iraq and Afghanistan from George Bush, and he has, you know, and really he ran on a pledge that he would end these wars. And what's interesting about the timing of this is that the last troops, if we follow the schedule he's just announced today, will pull out 20 days before he steps down as president in 2017. So, you know, he's trying to clean up that end. But I think that what you have to do is talk about some of the other countries that we've been talking about around this table in the last couple of weeks, Nigeria, Nigeria, Syria, the instabilities that are rising in those areas. And I think the U.S. simply has to start focusing on areas where they think they can actually make a difference. After 13 years in Afghanistan, I think the speaker we just heard said it all. And there really isn't much to show for it.
James.
Yeah, in the concept of full disclosure, I should point out that Scott Lucas was my PhD supervisor. So who am I to argue? But he's absolutely right. What has the US achieved? You know, there is not going to be a Jeffersonian democracy flourishing in Afghanistan. these were the long vested hopes of the Bush administration. They've achieved basically nothing, effectively, except an awful lot of loss of blood and treasure. What's going to come out of this? Very, very little, quite frankly. You're seeing a repositioning, I think, of US focus. We saw the speech today at West Point, where he's shifting, I think, from a focus upon the sort of AFPAC region to sort of more northern Central Africa, for example, looking at where the next generation of threats appear to be coming from. But this is very much is a fig leaf, I think, upon US foreign policy at this point.
And when we look at, you know, obviously here he's talking about, you know, military and about anti-terrorism moves. But the funny thing is that two of the kind of biggest successes, James, have been, you know, one, kind of Iran potentially. Two, the Russians haven't taken over all of Ukraine. They've snatched Crimea, but they've stopped. Oddly, no, they haven't done anything. It's diplomacy. Do you think that there's a recognition that actually in some of these bigger battles, you know, putting troops on the ground has just, you know, we'll cover some other stories later on that seem to still kind of reverberate from putting troops on the ground, that just doesn't work in the old way?
I think what you've seen is an administration that's come to office in 2008 and its focus was withdrawal and not follow-up deployment. It promised to get out of Iraq and Afghanistan. As Jeffrey rightly pointed out, no one, I think, thought it would possibly take the entire two terms to get out of Afghanistan. It's just unbelievable. And the issues that you talk about quite rightly there with regards to where America may have succeeded. Well, Iran is very much let's wait and see, because obviously the sanctions are being diminished, but there's no tangible results at that point. And what we're going to say, well, it's a success. There's not been a land war in Europe yet. I think if anybody seems to be playing an ace card there, it's Putin and certainly not Obama at this point.
And, you know, the same question to you, Jeffrey, in a sense, when you look at, you know, what happened in Iraq, what happened in Afghanistan, do you think there's any sense for America that it has any victory out of these things?
Oh, no. I think they're just trying to find a way not to acknowledge complete defeat. But I think it's very much shaped. I think Obama's presidency has been shaped by these wars he inherited that were misguided from the beginning. And he has tried to clean up the mess. I think you can take issue with how he's done it. But the reason the U.S. is not aggressive militarily these days is very much because Americans have seen the failure of aggression and the cost of it. And I'm not sure it's fair, though, to compare Ukraine. I mean, it's a very different. I think Putin was strutting in Ukraine. We've talked about that before. I don't think Ukraine is not an unstable region in the same way. That was an act of aggression by Putin to try to reclaim, I guess one could argue, a little bit of the Soviet grandeur.
But there was no commitment from America. It was completely clear. We're not putting troops on the ground. We're not getting involved.
No, but you know, I think in that case, not to get too far off topic here, but I think when Putin sort of started kicking the tires of eastern Ukraine and he realized, oh my God, you know, this is an old rusty vehicle with flat tires and the engine doesn't work, do I really want two more states or provinces of Ukraine that are essentially dysfunctional? You know, he made his point with Crimea. That's really the valuable piece of real estate for him. And I think he also seems to be recognizing the limitations of his own power. I don't know that we can make that parallel with Iraq and Afghanistan.
James, I can see you're trying
to
jump in.
Yeah, I think what's
here.
Fascinating here is that we're talking about Barack Obama announcing a new direction in U.S. foreign policy. This is a president who has got little over 2 years left in office. We're talking about him setting the agenda, not really just for his administration, but for the administration to come, effectively. And it's remarkable. This is the sort of speech you would have hoped to have had been delivered at the beginning of a term, you know, very much trying to set a new agenda, effectively. And it's remarkable, I think, that, you know, we're now talking, if you look at the West Point speech he gave today, talking about, you know, working with Congress to throw his weight behind, you know, some opposition movement in Syria. This is a speech that should have been given a long, long, long time ago. You know, the ball has moved on, effectively, and one wonders where American leadership is coming from. A lot of what he's talking about in terms of, you know, we can get involved, but it's got to be dependent upon U.S. national interest. It's going back to issues that Bill Clinton came out with, for example, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Well, I wonder, James, though, whether another president who a stronger leader than Obama would be able to do anything more than have stronger rhetoric in today's world.
Well, rhetoric, you know, the concept, isn't it? You know, where there's no vision, the people perish. I think one of the problems is if you look at Obama's opinion poll ratings in terms of foreign policy, they're just unbelievably low. You know, he has tried, I think, to reset U.S. foreign policy. He's tried desperately not to be George W. Bush. But whilst no one, I think, is going to sit around his table and lament the loss of George Bush's foreign policy, there is a sense that at least you knew what U.S. foreign policy right. stood for and where it was going. And I think there's been a rudderless concept and lack of leadership coming out of Washington in terms of foreign policy, other than we're in reverse, but it's not actually going forward anywhere.
Either of you jump in this, but I also wonder what's interesting is, you know, that we have this now, this kind of breakdown of relations between the U.S. and Russia. But if you're going to have a battle against terrorism, if that's going to be your front line, we saw with the, you know, the Boston bombing, there was links back to Russia. You kind of need Russia, America, China. They're all kind of facing a similar kind of problem with, you know, with Islamic groups. You know, we're seeing it in Africa as well. If there's not a bit of kind of joined up concerted effort between all of these capitals, does that kind of policy really work?
I'll take that. Why not? One of the interesting things about international terrorism is, you know, how many times in the US you see something go bang and there's a national tragedy, and the knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, this must be international Islamic terrorism. You know, we saw it in the immediate aftermath of Boston. We saw it with Oklahoma, for example. And time and again, what you see is an awful lot of homegrown domestic terrorism coming through. And you see, you're seeing China starting to suffer on this length, issues to do with Russia. So I think we have to be careful not to overstate the international dynamic of this, because time and again we see homegrown terrorist groups. They may well claim to have some sort of allegiance to an international following of some sort, but time and again we see much more sort of domestic-driven focus of terrorism, I think.
Well, let's move on now to a story which is very much homegrown for Americans. We're going to move to California and the aftermath of a horrific stabbing and shooting spree from a disturbed 22-year-old. Six people were killed by Elliot Rodger, who left a 141-page manifesto blaming his loneliness on his inability to attract girls. It almost became cliche in America now that a shooting spree happens, activists cry foul at the country's gun laws, and then nothing kind of ever changes. Let's just look at this case a little bit more in detail. I was looking at a conservative website just before we came on, looking at the numbers of crimes. They were saying the figure often quoted for the U.S. is 36,000. They said, well, take off 60%, because in fact that's suicide. Then of those remaining, 9,800 actually gang crime, so don't worry about those. Actually, they whittled it down to about kind of 1,800, and they said, in fact, these incidences for a country of 350 million people where 99% of people have access to a gun, or, you know, there's more guns. They were saying, actually, it's a pretty safe country.
They can say that all they want, but, you know, I'm as a journalist, you know, reporting in the U.S. for a very long time, it was, you know, it is kind of the shooting spree of the month, if not, you know, I mean, you know, and that's not a glib statement. It really is. And we know that. We hear them. We see them. I mean, that's a reductionist view of trying to rationalize and support gun rights. But it just doesn't work that way. And I think what's incredible for outsiders, and, you know, I'm originally from Canada, I moved to the U.S., but when you live in the U.S. a long time, you have to try to understand the values of gun ownership that are so seminal to the values of liberty and the American way. And you know, for an outsider, it just seems like, why don't you people get it? But when you're in America, people are fused to their guns in a way that just is part of their DNA.
James, is there nothing that's going to ever happen?
Well, just think about the track record. We've had presidents, we've had presidential candidates shot, we've had congresswomen shot, we've had children shot. You know, what will it take? Clearly nothing. Jeffrey's point is spot on. You can sit here in Europe, you can read your Guardian, you can drink your lattes, and you can say, why, oh, why don't the Americans get it? And that's a fundamental misunderstanding of Americana. And I've spoken to my students about this. I was chatting to one of my students this afternoon. Young, liberal, female, West Coast, East Coast, Central United States. All of them say, you know, this is a fundamental right of mine. Don't take away my guns. It's remarkable. And I don't think, unless you get the US, you can possibly understand that mindset.
You know, I don't know that all of them. I mean, I agree with you, and I think we're speaking of the same, from the same page. But I think there is a... I think there are a lot of Americans who share that sort of Guardian latte drinking view of soy latte, probably, of gun control. You know, it tends to be a more between the sort of central Midwestern view and Southern view of guns. But you know, when Gabby Giffords, the senator or the congresswoman, was shot in Arizona in the spring of 2011, that was the first time Obama actually spoke about gun control. I mean, you talk about Obama's spinelessness. Mm-hmm. You know, he, who clearly wants gun control, I mean, you know, you don't have to read between the lines, finally spoke out once after that, and then he folded up his tent. Well, it wasn't until December of 12 when those 20 students were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School, six teachers, that he actually spoke repeatedly about gun control. And I remember, you know, when that happened, and you know, of course we all remember that, and you thought, this is it. This is the one that's going to galvanize America.
The satirical magazine Onion yesterday had the headline, "No way to prevent this, says only nation where this happens regularly." I was looking at the statistics, though, and what was interesting is, it is much more nuanced than you think. When you look at Hawaii, there was, I think, one murder with guns last year. When you look at Virginia, there was like 230. When you looked at New York, there's 450. New Hampshire, 4. So it's not as though it's exactly even across America, is it? There are pockets where this seems to happen more often than not, California being one of them, that seems to be badly hit.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There are regional differences here, but to suggest, I think, that this is some sort of a bunch of rednecks clinging to their guns effectively is a massive, massive mistake, which I think far too many people in Europe believe. This is something which is a widespread national support. Okay, there'll be pockets of liberal elitism, I suppose, effectively, that would be very much saying, well, we don't want it, we don't want guns at all. But this is not a regional issue in terms of trying to somehow cling to an issue. This is very much a nationwide phenomenon, I think.
Well, we're going to leave that there and take a short break, but we're going to be back in just a moment.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is the journalist Jeffrey Kaufman and the political historian Dr. James Boyes. Let's turn now to Turkey, where 1 year ago today, protests erupted near Istanbul's Gezi Park, shocking many outsiders who'd come to see the country as largely immune from the urban chaos and demonstrations sweeping the broader region. And since then, the rather heavy-handed approach of Prime Minister Erdogan hasn't done much to persuade the world that there's a competent leader in charge. James, let's start with you. You know, as we said a year ago, the country kind of admired, you know, it was taking a stance against Assad. It was a regional player. It seemed to be this new diplomatic hub at the end of the Med. Economy doing great, carrying everyone with it, marching towards middle class for the whole nation. Now, we're not quite so sure what's going on. We don't like it so much, do we?
You know what? We're talking about a whole variety of countries here on a regular basis. But if you want to talk about a country which has got such an unimaginably difficult country to govern, I give you Turkey. Think about where it sits geographically, geopolitically. It's going to have one foot in Asia, one foot in Europe. It's trying to be, have, you know, it's got an Islamic element to it. It's going to have, you know, a non-religious element to it as well. It's trying desperately to, you know, get into the European Union, and yet at the same time appeal to a group of its demographics, which were very much more adhering to an Asian side of things. One wonders how on earth this country continues to be governable. And clearly, I think there's a massive struggle at this point to discern and which way the future lies.
Jeffrey, has it lost its role model status?
Oh, I think so, and I think that's very distressing. You know, when I covered the Arab Spring, I used to ask people all the time, so where do you want Libya, Egypt, Tunisia to go? And they would say, well, we want an Islamic democracy. And I would say to them, where do you see that? And they would only be able to point to Turkey. And of course, Turkey's meant to be a secular democracy in an Islamic state. Erdogan's changing that. And I think there's no question that he's lost a lot of his luster, and you know, his, you know, the corruption issues, the squelching of dissent, the Gezi Park anniversary, which we're celebrating now, or marking, I should say, not celebrating, excuse me, marking, you know, today, you know, all of that adds up to. So where is this model Islamic state or democracy that others can look to as a role model?
I want to fit in one more story while we're here in around the Med, because we're going to move now to Libya. Now, for decades, it was considered a rogue state and a problem country until a NATO intervention in 2011 ended in the death of Muammar Gaddafi. But in recent months, a succession of violent attacks has shown that building a coherent political system in the aftermath of regime change is still dangerous business. Countless militias have taken root around the country, and five leaders have been premier since Gaddafi. Relative recent toppling politics. Yesterday, gunmen attacked the home of the latest prime minister. Now, Jeffrey, you've won an Emmy Award for your coverage of the uprising in Libya. How do you perceive the country now and the situation there today with what you saw when you were first there?
You know, I think it was inevitable. Gaddafi ruled by not allowing the 6 million people of his country to have any centralized systems. He governed by not governing. There was, apart from the oil ministry, there really wasn't much of a government in Libya. And so it was a very much, the history is tribal and nomadic. And he very much kept control by keeping the people divided and creating sort of regional enmities. And so bringing the country together, there are no mechanisms of state to do that. And what I saw during that, as Gaddafi was toppled and ultimately killed, was this abundance of guns. I mean, I shiver when I think about it, but it was as if every male over 14 had an AK-47. And what was happening then was that people took these arms in the name of sort of toppling Gaddafi, but of course they kept them. And now we're seeing these very heavily powered militias in the name of regional power, regional pride, but ultimately profit and vanity, controlling and balkanizing the country. And so these premiers who you've talked about simply can't, they don't, you know, there's no there. They pull the levers of state and there's nothing connected. And so it's very worrisome. And I wonder how you end something like this, because ultimately one of the things that I've learned covering conflict up close is that, and I remember this in Iraq when Iraq was in its worst time. I remember a woman saying to me, you know, Saddam was terrible, but at least I could go around the corner and buy a loaf of bread without fear of being shot or my daughter being raped. And, you know, it's a very humbling thing to hear someone who, she didn't like Saddam, she wasn't, but you know, when the violence, when you can't live your day-to-day life, suddenly democracy feels like a luxury.
James, we were talking earlier on in the show about the failure of kind of big policy. You know, sure, we put troops on the ground. We helped this whole kind of process. We backed what was happening there. Now, just tell me, for you, when you see the situation in Libya, do you kind of agree with Jeffrey that in fact, kind of, there's nothing much you can do?
This is one of the great problems. You know, we in the West, I think, look at a variety of countries that have got strong iron men in control, effectively, and we say this is terrible. There's no democratic rule there. It's ruled by decree, effectively. It's a dictatorship. You know, whether it's a Stalin figure, whether it's a Gaddafi figure, you know, surely these people would be better off with freedom. And we've seen time and time and time again this idea that you take away that strong man. You know, we saw it with Saddam again, for example, and the country just collapses because these countries in in many ways are not true nations, effectively. They're tribal, as Jeffrey rightly pointed out. They're held together by a strong man, effectively from a central point of view, who rules by decree and makes sure that there is no emerging power base. And the idea of trying to impose Western-style democracy upon these nations that have no history or tradition of that has become a real problem. And we're seeing it time and again played out, that you try and impose these systems of government upon nations who have no track record of it, and you end up with absolute chaos.
And might I say, to go back to where we began our discussion at the top of the hour, you know, that may well be the fate of Afghanistan. You know, yeah. As the American troops pull out by 2017, there is every reason to think that the Balkanization and the regional militias will terrorize that country as they have in the past and are equipped to do in the future.
Well, gentlemen, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to leave it there. That was Jeffrey Kaufman and Dr. James Boyce. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's show. We're going to check in with our correspondents in Brussels. We're going to have a look back at the life of the visionary designer Massimo Vignelli. And we're also going to talk theatre with Matt Wolfe of the International New York Times. That's all in a moment.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette é Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Holanda,
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
This is Monocle 24.
It's time now to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. European Union leaders have ordered a review of its future direction after voters in many countries backed parties opposed to greater integration after elections across Europe last Sunday. Pro-EU parties, though, still hold a majority in the European Parliament. Ukraine has appealed for Russia to tighten border controls and prevent the flow of, as it put it, fighters and terrorists onto Ukrainian soil. The news comes as the Russian foreign minister repeated Moscow's call for an end to the interim Ukrainian government's military action against pro-Russian separatists in the east of the country. Outgoing Afghan President Hamid Karzai has welcomed a US decision to withdraw all troops by the end of 2016, saying this will give the Taliban a reason to end their insurgency and negotiate with the next government. And an organic farmer in Western Australia has lost his bid to claim damages from a neighbour after genetically modified canola seed heads blew onto his property, causing him to lose his licence as an organic grower. And that's later news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. The time now is 21:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, and 14:31 in Rio de Janeiro. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we head to Brussels, where our correspondent Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson awaits with the latest news from her patch of the world. Charlotte, welcome to the show. I think I know what you're going to be starting with, and that's the elections. Now, one of the big things to decide is who's going to be the president of the European Commission. And there have also already been some kind of attempts, I know, by the UK to stop certain people taking over.
Yes, that's right. It does feel like there's a bit of an almighty row brewing in Brussels, and that's something that Brussels tends to be quite good at, and one of the reasons, I think, why so many voters get so disillusioned with it, because what goes on here sometimes just seems, well, so complicated and so intricate and so obtuse. And this row over the European Commission president looks set to be one of these. Essentially, the Parliament, they want their candidate. This is Jean-Claude Juncker, the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg. They want him to be Commission President. 28 heads of state, they have some other ideas. Many of them are on the same page. They're quite keen on Mr. Juncker. But as you mentioned, David Cameron is doing his usual odd man out trick. And they've made it quite clear, Number 10 have made it quite clear, they're not so keen on Mr. Juncker. The reason being, he's one of these old school federalists who really believes that closer integration in the European Union is the way forward. And that's not really a particularly popular opinion in Britain right now, or indeed in France, as these elections have proved.
Now, tell me, we saw President Hollande yesterday, we've seen Cameron, we've seen even the kind of Hungarians saying, actually, it's time to have a bit of a rethink about what the EU's up to. It needs to do a little bit less. It needs to be better at connecting with people. It needs to, you know, explain its policies a bit better. Is there a candidate who would kind of appeal to all of those different nations?
it would be very difficult to find a compromise candidate who would appeal to everybody. None of the Parliament's other possibilities, as Martin Schulz, he's with the Socialists and Democrats on the centre-left, he's also pretty divisive for the same reasons, that he's very pro-integration, very pro-Europe. So they might be looking for a candidate from outside the Parliament, one that isn't an MEP. And some names that have come up in the past include Christine Lagarde, the current head of the IMF, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, the current Danish Prime Minister. Oh, it's difficult to say at the moment if any of those are really true contenders at the moment, because you hear so many different names. But they would be looking for somebody like that, somebody seen, if you look at Lagarde, seen as more politically neutral to take the post. But I think the question with someone like Lagarde is, would she really want the post?
Now, tell me, the next thing to think about is obviously Marine Le Pen, one of the far-right leaders who did rather well in this election, as did far-right parties in many of the nations. She's trying to look to form a group of various right-wing politicians. I know that actually the British contingent have said that actually they're not so keen on joining. And she's actually said that she won't join potentially with the German who has come out as a supporter of Hitler. But in the centre, all these right-wing parties, does it look like she's going to be able to form a quite powerful group?
Well, the evidence today doesn't suggest so. I mean, it's obviously the first day where this real manoeuvring starts to take place, but she just held a press conference here at the European Parliament, which, you know, it turned out they haven't managed to find any new partners. We already knew that she has got four other right-wing, far-right parties on board. But what you need to form a new official political grouping in the Parliament are, 25 MEPs from at least seven different countries. So she needs to find MEPs from two more countries before she can get this official political grouping. And as you mentioned, there are so many splits within these Eurosceptic, right-wing block of MEPs that she's going to struggle a little bit, especially as UKIP have made it quite clear they don't want nothing to do with her, and she's made it quite clear that she wants nothing to do with the more extreme far-right that's coming into the Parliament.
Now, Charlotte, you're sitting in Belgium, and it's a country that potentially might not exist in a few more years' time, looking at the new government.
Yes, that's right. So we did have the European Parliament elections, and everyone was quite focused on those on Sunday. But Belgium also held national elections. And if we look at what happened after their last elections in 2010, they managed to get a world record. But it wasn't any sort of great, cool world record. It was the world record for going the longest without a government, and that was 541 days. So there's a lot of fears that we're going to get a repeat of that here in Belgium, because the reason for this problem last year was that the Separatist Party did rather well, and rather better than expected, so all the other coalition partners had to horse trade to keep them out of power. But on Sunday, this Separatist Party did even better. It won the most votes. So this is why there are fears that we're just going to have another long, long political stalemate in Belgium for months to come.
And it's a slightly tough call for the king. I understand that he has to kind of ask this Separatist Party now to potentially form a government. Is that correct? Because he's kind of asking somebody to kind of get rid of his job.
Well, exactly, yes. The MVA have not been very keen on the monarchy. I interviewed one of their MPs last year when the new King Philippe came to power, and they were quite clear that they are a Republican party. So this is slightly odd, seeing these pictures of the King shaking hands with Bart De Wever, the head of the Separatist Party. But the Separatists, they've been canny. They've made it clear that if they do form a government, they're not going to head straight into splitting up the country. They've shifted their focus somewhat to economic issues. So if they did manage to form a government, it wouldn't be quite so bad as everyone thinks. But at the same time, I mean, it's really unlikely that any of the French parties are going to let him form this government. They're just not going to join his coalition. So this is why there are these fears of long, long turmoil here.
Well, Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us for the moment from Belgium. Well, that was Charlotte McDonald-Gibson, who is, of course, our correspondent in Brussels. Up next, we're going to look back at the life and times of the acclaimed graphic designer Massimo Vignelli.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. The acclaimed designer Massimo Vignelli has died, aged 83. Vignelli has been called the visionary who untangled the subway by the New York Times. And while his beautiful New York subway map was indeed one of his most widely seen creations, Vignelli's influence has stretched from shopping bags and book covers to logos and furniture. Michael Beirut from the design firm Pentagram has said that Massimo, more than anyone else, gets the credit for introducing a European modernist point of view to American graphic design. Well, a bit earlier, Monocle's creative director Richard Spencel-Powell spoke with our design editor Tom Morris to look back at Massimo Vignelli's life and times.
Vignelli's famous for many, many projects that he did over the sort of past four decades. But what do you think will be his kind of longest legacy?
If I had to pick one, it's probably the one that is the last project standing, really, and it's probably the best, and it's the New York subway.
Yeah.
It's the signage for the transit system, it's the map, it's the, you know, everyone knows it, the circles, the coloured circles with Helvetica in. His other most famous project is American Airlines, which unfortunately up until about 2 years ago, maybe less, was the only airline that had never been rebranded.
Yeah.
And that American Airlines had stood since the 60s. And
45 years, wasn't it?
45 years. And I think the only reason actually that they changed it, if you believe sort of aviation myth, is that American Airlines used to have the kind of aluminium fuselage, or not aluminium, steel, I guess. And that apparently was because they couldn't afford to paint the planes. And then when they bought new Boeing Dreamliners that are, they're not made of metal, I think, probably got that wrong, but they had to change the colour. So suddenly they got a colour, so they rebranded, which is a shame because otherwise that would have been the most timeless, I think, of airline identities. People think it's Lufthansa, which I think Otto Leicher did. But actually that would have been redesigned about four times. So his one was the longest running.
Yeah.
And I can't see them ever changing the New York Underground. I think there'd be a riot if anyone tried to mess with it. I mean, it's so famous that that map has been copied, I mean, all over the world. And so has that signage system. And, you know, this is, people think that, you know, because Helvetica is quite ubiquitous, that it's, you know, it's a very easy thing to use. I mean, yeah, it is easy to just key it in and use it on anything, but to use it as well as he did, to get the kind of all the kerning absolutely perfectly right and get that colour palette and get it working with the colour palette, you know, it's a real sort of work of genius, and its influence will be long, long lasting. And he was one of the last remaining great, great graphic designers, you know, one of the true people that helped sort of set the international style. And yeah, it's a big icon that I think would be massively missed.
Yeah. I mean, many of his things sort of known for their kind of classical Helvetica edge, but he was actually, I guess, the Italian tradition, a lot more playful in some of his earlier stuff like Cinzano and the stuff he did for Ford and Bloomingdale's. It was, he actually had that sort of sense of slight Italian flair, which I guess slightly re-educated the Americans into how they thought about graphic design, do you think? Or
yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think European use of kind of modern international style is always more playful. The Dutch are very good at that, better than the Swiss. I mean, the Swiss are very sort of grid-like, as you'd expect. Vignelli was playful, and, you know, he sort of famously said in the Gary Huswitz film Helvetica that he felt there was only ever sort of 8 or 9 good typefaces in the world, and that's a sort of thinking, the sentiment that I agree with. And so he set up his stall with quite a kind of constrained set of parameters, and yet still was colourful, playful, could deliver charm. I mean, and you're right, Cinzano, it's a classic. It's a brilliant bit of work, and stuff he did for Knoll as well.
Yeah.
Big American corporate multinationals, and he still delivers something with a lot of character.
Yeah. He had a good sense and understanding of heritage as well. And I think that's probably why he was so critical of kind of the new American Airlines identity, because it did just sort of, I mean, there was the eagle and stuff that owed to kind of the heritage of American Airlines, but when he did it, you know, he borrowed that eagle from the sort of the branding that existed before, the Cinzano, he sort of, and the Ford Oval, he sort of borrowed,
yeah,
kind of worked in the vein as what came before him. It wasn't,
yeah, there was a degree of respect there, and I think he actually left. I think the American Airlines identity was designed when he was at, I think it's Unimark, and he ended up leaving there when he felt that the design was becoming sort of second fiddle to marketing. And I think it's probably down to his sort of European roots. I mean, that's the thing, he was not born in America, he was truly Italian. So I think he was lucky in that he had all of the influences from Italy, which I think he's got, although people don't credit it for being a country with great graphic design, they're great at signage. You know,
they're great at logo, yeah.
You know, they're great at style, but everyone references the Dutch, you know, or the Swiss or the Germans or the Brits, but actually, you know, Italy is logo land. I mean, it's heaven out there.
Yeah, which is what he seemed to really understand. And
yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think, you know, it's he'll be sorely missed, and it's he was a giant in sort of graphic design terms, and I think it was just a real class act.
Yeah,
and gave quite a lot back. You know, they set up a foundation, I think.
An incredibly pleasant guy to work when he, I think it was even, came out of hospital a couple of weeks ago, and I think his son asked for anyone who'd been inspired by him or met him to sort of send cards, and apparently the response was absolutely incredible, with, you know, young sort of fans and then old people that worked with him in the 60s, and obviously left a big legacy of friendship behind as well.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I mean, they just don't get much bigger than Vignelli.
Well, that was Richard Spencer Powell, Monocle's creative director, with Tom Morris, our design editor, on the life and times of Massimo Vignelli, who has just died. It's time now for a bit of music. Well, in memory of Vignelli and his influence on the New York City subway design, let's hear a classic from Tom Waits, circa 1985. Here's Downtown Train.
Outside another yellow moon, his pawns so old in the nighttime. I climb to the window and down to the street. I'm shining like a new dime. The downtown trains are full for all those Brooklyn girls.
Well, that was Downtown Train by Tom Waits, and up next we're going to talk theatre. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and time now to review the best and sometimes the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, music, books and more. And today we're going to talk theatre, and here to take me through the best and maybe the worst is Matt Wolfe, the London theatre critic for the International New York Times and a great friend of Monocle 24. Great to have you back as always, Matt.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
Let's start with Miss Saigon, which is back in London. It's 25 years since it was first done.
Yeah.
And a show, I guess, that was famous as much for its props as its cast. It had this amazing helicopter scene. Tell us, who's the star of it this time, the helicopter or the stars?
This show, believe it or not, is about the people. How radical. What a thought that is. It's actually extraordinary to think that there was a time in the British mega musical when we applauded the machinery. And in this production, there still is a helicopter. You know, if you want to go see a chopper, you'll see one on stage at the Prince Edward Theatre. But the people are in the foreground. The disadvantage of that, I suppose, is that you realize that the material is pretty manipulative. The advantage of it is that it gives pride of place to this really wonderful 18-year-old newcomer called Ava Niblazada, who's Filipino-American. She's never been in a professional show anywhere. And it's astonishing that she was tapped for this, and it's astonishing that she's as good as she is.
So remind us, who wrote this originally?
This is by the team, the Les Mis team of Claude Michel Schoenberg and Alain Bublil, with the American Richard Maltby Jr. Helping out. And it was, you know, the end of a decade that began with Cats, Les Mis, and Phantom, and then was capped by Miss Saigon, four musicals that began in Britain and toured the world. And this was the one that, in a way, got almost the best reviews of all of them, famous originally for Jonathan Pryce's performance, but also very controversial because he wasn't an Asian performer, and that caused a big hoo-ha in New York. In this production, they have a Filipino-born performer, John Briones, playing the Jonathan Pryce role, and he's very good as well. So the people do make it worth seeing.
And just tell me, you know, with 25 years greater distance. So the audience seeing it 25 years ago, actually Vietnam was kind of in the memory of many of the adults going to see it. As you mean, the adults going to see it now would probably be very hazy on it happened when they were kids. Does it have a different meaning, do you think, 25 years later?
It doesn't really matter whether it's a documentary, a quasi-documentary approach to Vietnam or not. It sort of stands or falls on its human content and the waste of war. And the waste of war, of course, is ongoing.
Well, we're going to move on now because the Pajama Game is also back in London. Now, it's a show that first came out in 1954 and doesn't get done too often in a high-tech way. And but anyway, it's back in town. It's directed by Richard Eyre. And actually, we have a little clip, which I believe is... I'm hoping this is the actual cast rather than just someone we found from 1954.
We'll see.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her, her with her nose in the air.
Very nice song, Matt.
Yeah.
And is that from the show?
Well, the song is from the show. I would not want to say on air necessarily who's singing it, but it's a song famously covered by Frank Sinatra, as many people of a certain vintage will know. What's interesting about that song, Andrew, is that it does offer its own technology after a fashion 1954 style, because it's a solo that's actually a duet, in that the character Sid Sorokin is singing it along with his dictaphone. So that's pretty high tech for the mid-50s.
Now, we didn't get Hey There, which is my kind of... which is kind of the hit we all kind of like. Now, is there any point in redoing the Pajama Game? Is it still a great show?
I'm not sure it was ever a great show, to be absolutely honest. It's one of those musicals, kind of like Damn Yankees from the mid-50s, that isn't quite Guys and Dolls and never became South Pacific of the King and I, but it's got a really wonderful score. And those were the days, the golden age of Broadway, when you came out of the theater humming the tunes, and you really do in this production. Whatever the kind of strangenesses of some of the casting, the female lead is too old. There's not a lot of chemistry between the two leads, but the score is great. And that song is one of the reasons why.
Now, it's about a strike in a pajama factory, isn't it? They're going on strike for a bit more pay. So it's relevant to these kind of times of austerity. People want a bit more. Do they make it relevant to today in any sense?
Thank God, no. This has not been updated to God knows where. We do have a musical coming up in the autumn that will do that, Maid in Dagenham. So let's leave Gemma Arterton to do that in due course. No, it sort of presents it as it is, which is as you would wish. But yeah, it's the background of unions and labor. Who knew?
Who knew? And even the version, the idea of pajamas, who wears them anymore? Well, maybe. I'm not, maybe you have your own silk pair of an evening, Matt. I don't know.
I couldn't possibly comment at this time of day. But I do think it's interesting that pajama is one of those words that spell differently in the UK from the US. So I suppose in Britain, it's the pyjama game.
Yeah, we call them PJs.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, so do we.
We're going to move on. An American star is back in town. Kathleen Turner's return to the West End in Bakersfield Mist. What did you make of this?
Well, you know, first of all, can we just doff our cap collectively to Kathleen Turner? This is a woman who has now done five plays in the UK, three in London, two in Chichester, in the last decade or so. And that's pretty amazing. She was, of course, a great siren and femme fatale of movies in the 1980s. She's had much chronicled ill health, which she's been the first to talk about. And what's wonderful is that she's come out the other side as a feisty, blousy, go-getting actress, of a certain age who's not going down with the ship. And in this, she plays, guess what? A feisty, blousy woman living in a trailer encampment in Bakersfield, California, who may or may not have a Jackson Pollock worth $100 million in her midst. And Ian McDiarmid plays the art historian who comes to assess it.
And this is based on a true story, isn't it?
Yeah. It's based on it. Although it's one of these things where it's kind of been factionalized so that nobody gets sued. But the problem with it as a piece is it's one of those kind of formulaic two-handers where the opposites are very firmly announced and then each person exists to teach the other one a life lesson. So that gets to be a bit didactic. But the real reward of it is watching Turner just steamroll her way through 75 minutes at the Duchess Theater. And nobody does it the way she does. Nobody sounds the way she does. She's got this kind of fantastic growly voice that each time she comes to London, it seems to have slightly dipped an octave.
And just tell me, finally, she's someone who's kind of really made that transition to theatre. She's as good as on theatre as in film, isn't she?
Well, she began on the stage, and what's wonderful is she gets older. She's returning to her roots, ending where she started.
Well, we love Kathleen Turner.
We do.
I've seen her. I think she was in Enfant Terrible, wasn't she, with Jude Law many years
Broadway,
ago.
Indiscretions, that's right.
That's
absolutely.
Right. Well, it was Enfant Terrible here because we had it in French here.
On Broadway, it was Indiscretions because we didn't speak French in New York.
You saw Jude Law's bottom. What more can I say? Now, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and James Boyes. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Carlotta Rebello. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. Next, after the headlines, it's The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. Then at 2200 hours, it's time for The Monocle Daily. And this show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time for me to say goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.